Welcome, movie fans. Thanks for joining us for episode 89 of Reading Between the Reels, the premier podcast of heartfelt legacy sequels. If you're a new listener, you're so glad you found us. If you've been enjoying the show, please tell someone about us. Post on X or Facebook, write a review in your favorite podcast catcher, or just recommend the show to a friend. I'm Craig Dickinson. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Corey Heitschmidt, Justin Olden. What's up, fellas? How are we doing tonight?
I'm doing fantastic, Craig. This is my 46th podcast, and I think I'm going to catch my voice this time.
46 already?
No, it's from the movie.
It's a movie reference.
This is a podcast about movies.
I didn't get the reference.
That's it.
Okay.
Cut.
Start over. All right. Take two.
Justin. You really want to start over?
I just want to express my extreme sadness that I always go second when you introduce us because Corey stole my joke.
Look at that. And you know what, Justin? I really want to express that that's why I always jump out and say something first so that I can make sure that I steal jokes.
Nicely done. So what movie are we watching, Justin? What are we talking about tonight?
What movie are we watching?
Yeah, what are we talking about tonight?
Oh, we're talking about Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Yeah. Which is exciting because if I'm not mistaken, neither of you guys had seen this movie before we did it for the show. Is that right?
Yes.
Correct. Yes.
I did not watch this until last week. Now, wait a minute. Let's preface that. Me not watching it was not because I didn't want to see it. And we'll end up getting to it, but I tell you what, I regret not seeing it in the movie theater.
Justin, what about you?
Yeah, I love Ghostbusters. I grew up watching Ghostbusters. Like, it's one of those movies that we just had, and I watched all the time. So I honestly can't tell you why I didn't watch this. I just didn't.
Yeah. November 11th, 2021.
Yeah, theaters barely just opened after COVID. You guys both got small kids, so I mean, that might have been harder just to make some time to do that. But let's go ahead and what do you guys think? Let's talk about overall thoughts. Justin, I will start with you.
Overall thoughts. I thought it was fantastic. It was a fun time. And sometimes I have one opinion about a movie and then a couple days later, a couple hours later, I end up developing another opinion. Like Star Wars Episode 9, I actually liked it when I came out of the theater. And then 10 minutes later, I'm like, wait a second. Anyway, this was not one of those. I liked it right after and I liked it later. It does a good job of, I mean, it does what a legacy sequel is supposed to do, right? It pays homage to the original and sets up a new franchise at the same time. Acting was fantastic. McKenna Grace, who plays Phoebe, the girl, Spangler's granddaughter. Oh my goodness. Super excited for, you know, the rest of her career because she was awesome. Yep. I don't know if she's going to be able to like continue acting because I know she's had some, back troubles like from carrying this entire movie. I know that was hard for her. But
is this true? Is this true about back troubles?
No, that's a joke you say about people that carry movies.
That's beautiful.
Geez. Oh, it's good. It was so good.
Premier podcast of misunderstanding jokes.
Yeah, I tell you, all day today.
No, I thought it was great. I want to ask a question later in this to all of you guys, but my question was always, does it lean too heavily on the assumption that you've watched the original Ghostbusters, or does it lean too heavily on nostalgia? Like, would it exist? Would it still be good without those things? You don't have to answer that now.
Yeah, I had a similar question, so I'm glad that you're thinking along those lines. Corey, what about you? What are your overall thoughts on Ghostbusters Afterlife?
Of all the movies we've done lately, I got to admit, this has been the favorite one that I've done so far. I mean, this was just a dang fun movie. And Justin, you hit it. It leans a lot on nostalgia. I think this is a lesson for all these people that are trying to decide whether to do a reboot, like the other Ghostbusters movie was, a reboot of a franchise, or whether to pay homage to an older version and then kind of create another sequel, continue the character and the arcs that you had before. And there's a reason this movie has another sequel coming out. It's because it was so good. It was so well written. I'm going to tell you, I cried and cried at the end of this movie. even though I knew, because I'd seen TikTok videos, I knew what was coming up with Egon at the end, the ghost and everything. Doesn't matter. Watching it in the movie in the full context and seeing the whole scenes play out, I'm still not a dry eye. I'm sitting there watching and crying in my living room, watching the show. And then afterwards I yank my wife and I'm like, you get in here. You got to watch this part. Oh my gosh. And I don't know how she wasn't crying. I was like, you don't understand what this is. Like, and so it's just it was an epic ending. It was an epic continuation of the characters. And it kind of shows where sometimes I think Star Wars Episode 7 missed the mark. This movie nails the mark. Bringing in those characters that you love, even though one of them's dead. And we still gave them the screen time. We still gave them the honor that they deserved in the scene. And the moment of seeing some kind of resolutions in their character. And some kind of continuation in their character. And that's why I fell in love with this movie. I was like, doggone it. This is a perfect movie, I think, for the whole – I mean, to make a trilogy out of that. I mean, I don't know. The second one, yeah, it's kind of – you know, Viggo, he's good. But I think Ghostbusters is incredible, that movie. The whole movie, Ghostbusters, was a thing of the time, right? And I think this movie is just a perfect movie on it. And can I just tell you, when you're watching the movie and you just hear the little – we're going to talk about music later, but you're going to hear the little Ghostbuster themes and old songs and soundtracks kind of going in the background. Chills at how good it was. So
yeah, like anytime they like trilled that piano, you're just like,
Yeah.
They made us wait until the very end for Ray Park. But, you know, I mean the whole thing, I loved it.
Yeah, Ray Parker Jr.'s theme. At
the finally, end. Yeah, a podcast where I'm on here, where I like the movie that we're talking about. I mean, all the other podcasts, it's been a bit of a dry spell for me. I've been like, it's all right. Now I'm like, yes, I'm full on board, and I can't wait to go see the next one.
All right. I have a question for you guys. Did you know from the get that the family was Spangler's daughter and grandkids?
Yeah.
Because the marketing for that made it look like you couldn't quite tell what was going on. It was a little bit of a mystery.
Little girl.
Right. I mean, there was a little bit of a mystery box aspect. But yeah, no, that's one thing I had just skipped down a little bit to hair and makeup and costumes and stuff is that she's clearly patterned after Harold Ramis's look from the original Ghostbusters.
I think it was the fact that in the opening scene where it's not showing his face, but you do see his like trademark hair.
Big hair.
Yeah. His big hair. That's when I'm like, okay, obviously this is Spangler.
Yeah.
But he always had that one curl that was always down. That's the thing that stuck out and was hanging down. And it was in the cartoons, they drew it real pronounced. And she had it all the movie, the whole time, just in the exact perfect spot. Like that was perfection, how they got her hair to do it. You can kind of make the kid look like someone that's related to him, but they did her so well. I mean, it was spot on. So there's no mistake. That's Egon's granddaughter.
Well, the thing I like about this too is just a little bit behind the curtain too, is that you have Jason Reitman, the son of the original director, Ivan Reitman, made this film. So it's like there's fathers and sons or parents and sons or parents and daughters like happening behind the scenes. And you have Dan Aykroyd's daughter as a cameo in this. There's such a family element to this. And there's like Jason Reitman is building on the legacy of his father, clearly, now doing a sequel to one of his father's most famous movies. So you have that passing of the torch there and the passing of the torch within the film. And it just feels to me very sincere. It doesn't feel like, fan service because of that to me. It kind of goes up to the line on a couple of things, but it feels authentic to me. It does feel, like I mentioned in the opening, it feels heartfelt. Like this is a tribute to the original film as much as it is.
It's a love letter to his dad. I mean, it's clear. I got to tell you, it sets me up a little bit on the fence of when we go see the next one, is it going to have the same payoffs that this does, the same emotion and feeling that I had here because it's not directed by him? And is it going to have the same jokes, the same thing, or is it going to hit a little differently?
Yeah.
Because this clearly was a perfect continuation. You could tell. I mean, he sat and he's talked to these characters over this story, these possible trilogies, sequels. I mean, he's probably had these conversations with Harold Ramis growing up, and then to make this, and then but now we have a new guy, so we'll see how this pays out.
I feel like I'd be happy either way, because with this one, I feel like they paid their dues to the original while starting, you know, the new franchise. So the next one, I'd be more okay if they branched out. But going back to your original comment, Corey, about like Star Wars Episode 7, I feel like in a lot of ways this like parallels Episode 7, because Episode 7 tried to do what Star Wars Episode 4 did. Like, it's, I mean, people have complained about this over and over, but it's almost the exact same plot as Episode 4, just with updated characters. And this, in a lot of ways, was the exact same plot as the original Ghostbusters, where they're trying to, you know, bring back Gozer, and they're going through all the things, and they have, you know, side characters. And anyway, it was like beat for beat very similar. But it did a much better job of it than Episode 7 did. Like, Episode 7 felt unnecessary.
Well, and I want to jump in too, Corey, like, about what you said about the fact that Jason Reitman's not directing Frozen Empire. It's Gil Keenan, who was a co-writer on this film, but basically they're partners. And so Reitman is also screenwriting for Frozen Empire. So it's going to be, it's essentially the same team. One of them's, you know, top dog in the different films, but I think it's probably going to feel like a pretty natural sequel to this film. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what direction they take it in, because there is even more, it almost feels like from the trailers, it's even more of a sequel to the original films, that like everybody's back again, and more so than cameos where they just showed up at the end. Which I wanted to say, one last thing I wanted to say about that too, is if you know anything about the background of the movie Groundhog Day, which Harold Ramis directed and Bill Murray stars in, like, those two guys had a falling out during that movie and didn't talk for several years up until right before Harold Ramis died. And so seeing that scene too, where the ghost of Egon is there and you just see the look on Bill Murray's face, I mean, that had to have been pretty cathartic for him too. Like, there's some real emotion in that scene.
Yeah.
And for all those guys, they knew, you know, they knew Harold Ramis for several years, for decades.
Yeah,
and for the most part, we're friends for, you know, for a long time.
There's got to be a little bit of truth. It wasn't probably hard or too far of a stretch to act those couple lines right there with Harold.
Okay, so let's just go ahead and jump into the movie. The aspects of it, cinematography, composition, color, camera work. Justin, I'm going to start with you again. What are some things that you noticed and what you pulled out from the film?
So I think this part feels probably the most different, like in terms of camera work and cinematography from the original, just because the world of 1984 filmmaking is quite a difference from, what was this, 2006? No, when did this come out? Not 2006.
2021.
Yep. Yeah. Very different filmmaking techniques, but they did a good job in terms of making it feel very isolated. You're in this small town. There's not a lot of resources. There's really no one to call for help. You're even further isolated, you know, in that farmhouse where, I mean, it's scary. Like, who are you going to call for help?
Ghostbusters.
But just overall, like, the colors, like, you got the warm hues of the farm. Like, it can feel homey, but at the same time, very creepy. And then kind of same thing with the town. Like, the town feels very homey, but at the same time, a lot of horror movies take place in small towns like that. And it can kind of double as giving off both of those vibes, which I just thought was fantastic. And then, like, a lot of close-up shots, and a lot of close-up shots on kids, which is where I think, like, McKenna Grace just did a fantastic job, because she nails those close-ups. Finn Wolfhard, who played Trevor, the Stranger Things kid, that one, like, every close-up shot of him, like, I don't know what it is about this film, but I feel like he fell flat a little bit. Like, he didn't really need to be in there. They're like, oh, it's a 1980s nostalgia film. Let's put this kid in. And it didn't work. But, yeah.
All right. Corey?
You know, as far as color, I think it's, since it's a ghost movie, you got to have some of that ghost feel. So I think there's a lot of rustic look into it. Everything's worn in this town, you know, versus a big city, flashy colors. There's not a lot of bright colors everywhere. Everything's got that rustic, dusty. Even Ecto-1 is rustic and covered in dust and scratches. And then the thing that I notice is there's lots of dark angles. And what I mean is there's times where anytime you knew something was going on, there's always a corner that was dark in the screen. Like you just, something's there, something's peeking. You know, you kind of get that feeling like when you're in the dark and you feel like something's watching you. Right. So they'd be walking on the stairs and it's like, dude, none of the lights in this house light up the rest of the corners, or is it only right where they're walking? Like it kind of creates that little spooky atmosphere a little bit, which I thought was great. There's a couple times where they have some slow walk ups leading to things rather than just like you hear a noise. Like if I hear a noise, I'm busting through my house. I'm walking through. I'm like, what the heck was that? You know, but they're stepping out slow. There's a lot of slow walk-ups. And it's kind of like the library scene in the original one where they're peeking around the corner to see the ghost librarian sitting there. And then they lean back. There's a couple comments. They lean forward, see her. You know, I mean, and it's building the scene and the intensity. I think they do that several times. And then last thing I'd say, the one, I don't know why, it stood out in my head. I felt it was a very 80s dissolve they did from the mine shaft to the farm. And Ecto-1 in the kids were at the mine shaft, and all of a sudden they're at the end of that scene where the thing shot out of it, right? They're at the mine shaft. They dissolve the camera and it dissolves back to the mine, to the farm and Ecto-1. And in my head, I heard the line from Spaceballs. Nice dissolve. Like it just was in my head. I go, oh my gosh, this is so 80s right here to see. Nice dissolve. It was so funny. It was hilarious. And it was
I really dislike when movies do that, like a lot.
Is the dissolve a thing again? I mean, it was kind of one of those that was such a, oh my gosh, did they just like edit this on the iPhone, the app on the iPhone so that you could just add a dissolve in the scene right here to link between the two? I don't know. It was just, it was campy. It was great. I felt it was an homage back to the old 80s shows. And I liked it. I thought it actually stuck the landing for me because I was like, nice dissolve.
Anytime there's a dissolve, it reminds me of like the first time someone plays with the dissolves on PowerPoint.
Yes.
And it's like a new random dissolve every time. And you're just like,
that's what they're trying to recapture on PowerPoint. That's what we grew up with, man.
It worked here.
Same with Star Wars. I hate it when Star Wars does that so much.
They do the sweeps.
The wipes. Yeah, the wipes are great. Those. All right. I want to talk about just briefly how well they hid that it wasn't actually Harold Ramis at the beginning. Like the composition there and the color and the lighting where you're just seeing him in silhouette or you're seeing him just in profile, I thought was great. So, I mean, you could, like Justin, like you mentioned, you could kind of tell it was him from the hair. You knew who it was supposed to be, but I thought it was really cleverly done so that you could get away with having not that actor play that character and not pulling you out of the film. And then you have that shot. There's a couple shots at the end, especially where it's a close up on Egon's ghost's hand on Phoebe's hand. And then they pan back out, they pull out. So you get to see that it's the ghost. Every time just gets me. Music swells that way, and then you get to see the four of them side by side, four original Ghostbusters. Like, that shot is just, yes, this is what we came to see. And, like, I don't want to harp on
Bill Murray's face right there, too. Just looks over.
I don't want to harp on Star Wars too much, but it's like one of the guys was dead, and they still got them all together. So,
yeah,
that it absolutely plays. Like, I grew up in the 80s and loved that original movie. And so that seeing those four guys together again, and a thing we thought we'd never get, especially after Harold Ramis died, was just amazing. So other things with color, one thing that I really liked is when they go, when Trevor and his new friends go to the Shandor mines, like it's totally like golden hour. It's beautiful. Like the sun's just going down. And like, it's one of the scariest parts of the film. Early on, before, so I love how there's kind of that bait and switch where they kind of lull you into this false sense of security. Everything's gonna be fine, but just the how beautiful it is, and you have all these great wide establishing shots of the landscapes. You know, it's filmed in Canada, but it's made to look like it's in the Midwest.
That's very different
from New York. Yeah,
and no way. I didn't know Canada had that.
It apparently does. So I love that they are able to kind of to separate from the, you know, the New York, the Manhattan aesthetic, and it still works. A couple other things I really like, just real quick, is when there's an extreme close-up on the chessboard, you get to see the pieces moving. And then there's a rack focus back out to the PKE meter, which lights up. Because you know, like, Egon's in the room moving the chess pieces around.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think...
I got a comment about that. I'm sorry. I have to sidebar that. The part that... Okay, if I'm in a house... and I'm watching chess pieces move on their own, I'm not going to just be like, okay, well, I'll move knight to king 4. Okay, take that.
She's a scientist, Corey.
And then she hears a noise, and she looks up and gets up and just walks away from this magic chessboard where something was moving. And she just – it's almost like those commercials you see now where they're on TikToks now. Where what it's like to be a person who has ADD, where they come in and they're trying to clean some dishes and they open the fridge and then they realize they got to clean the fridge and then they open up start cleaning the fridge. They realize they got to organize the pantries and they just move through task to task without ever completing one of the tasks, right? It's kind of how my brain works too, by the way. And so
I feel like
she's doing that with the ghost thing. She's playing chess with a ghost. She gets up and goes walking down the hall because she heard a noise. And then she just continues on. She gets this old flashlight and starts walking in here. Next thing you know, she's working on Egon's backpack, trying to put these plutonium devices back together. And the light is moving on its own, like the direction she's looking.
The lamp.
And I thought, and she's not freaking out at all. She's just like, well, okay.
She's a scientist.
So part of me for that part, I was like, holy cow, she's just embraced the role.
So here's my wife had the same complaint. And anytime me and my wife disagree or have like anything to talk about, one of us has to play devil's advocate. So my devil's advocate here, locked and loaded. Okay, so this is a world where the Ghostbusters exist. They're famous. They're still within living memory for a lot of people. There's memorabilia about them. There's, you know, people, they're well known. People know the Ghostbusters. So maybe ghosts aren't as like, maybe they're more commonplace than they are today. So maybe it's like, oh, random chess piece move it. No, that's totally fine. That happens.
Yeah. Well, I think too, you're seeing, like Phoebe is probably on the autism spectrum. She mentions that, you know, there's just comments about like inside she's vomiting or whatever. There's a line about. Gruberson trying to get with her mom. Like she's, you know,
premier podcast of medical diagnosis.
She's not outwardly expressive in that way. So
yeah,
might throw that in. The last thing I wanted to say about cinematography before I move on to sound, because there's a lot of good stuff in there, is we talked about a little bit how there's a lot of kind of traditional 1980s filmmaking, but I think there's some great 21st century filmmaking in where we see the Muncher chase, where you have multiple mixes of angles. You got the bird's eye view looking down on the car as it's driving through the city or through the town there. You got low angle on level with the trap. You got a bunch of mix of wide and mid shots. And then you have this beautiful wide shot of the Ecto-1s on the far left, Munchers on the far right, with the proton pack is just blasting all the way across. It's almost like a painting. We just weren't able to get those shots in the 80s just because of, you know, limitations on CGI and everything. I just really like that we get to see them in full action in an action sequence in a ghost. There really wasn't action sequences in Ghostbuster films, but this was a pretty good example of one.
That was a great that whole scene with that car driving and catching that first ghost. That was a great, like you said, it was the action scene of the movie more than just we drive, we show up, and we shoot the proton packs. There was a lot of action. The chase in that was fantastic. What were you saying, Justin?
I appreciate that how similar they tried to make the look of the streams from the proton pack, even though it was, you know, done CGI and technology has advanced quite a bit since the 80s. It still felt very much like the original. Like they could have made it look more real, and I feel like they intentionally held back, and I appreciated that.
You got to make it line up.
I do. I love that ghost. I could have loved a Slimer cameo. I hope he's in the next one. I don't know, but
I was surprised they didn't.
It's kind of like it was a Slimer type ghost.
He's a Manhattan ghost, though.
Yeah.
I bet we do see him in the next one. Yeah.
They could have had him in a trap or something, pop out of a trap. You know, there's ways.
He's definitely not a smart ghost because he can only fly over roads. Did anybody else notice that? Like, had he taken a right angle and flew over the field, I think he would have got away.
You're talking about Muncher now?
Yeah. Muncher ghost.
Oh, you got to wait for your fly through building ability to recharge. You can only do it so many times.
Yeah. There's laws and rules.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Justin, tell us about the sound stuff you saw or heard, I should say.
I don't see sound.
Synesthesia. Craig.
I thought it was fantastic. Okay, so here's order of events. I haven't seen the original Ghostbusters in probably 10 years. So I watched this and I didn't really pick up on a whole lot of nostalgic noises. And I was a little bummed that we didn't even have the main Ghostbusters theme until the very end. So after watching this, I went back and watched the original Ghostbusters, and then I realized, holy crap, this thing is just full of like original Ghostbusters throwbacks. We mentioned like the piano trill earlier. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was the same note for note, but a lot of it was very similar to the library scene, like the very slow opening and just like the off chord keys being played there to add a layer of suspense and worry and wonder. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed like, I feel like let me check my notes here. Sorry. Like every single character every single main character with the exception of Podcast has their own. What's the word, Craig?
Leitmotif?
There we go. Leitmotif.
Leitmotif.
Podcast didn't seem to have one, but everyone else did, unless I missed it. Why is that, Craig? What'd you think?
I will have to listen for that next time. That's not something I caught this time. So.
Oh, I caught something.
I don't have an answer for that.
Guys.
I've got other stuff, but I don't have that.
They had a really good mix of kind of throwbackish rock anthems, as well as new age songs, which all felt still very Ghostbuster-y. And I feel like 80s movies, that's what they're so good at. They're so good at their music. And this one nailed it. It was fantastic music added to every scene, whether action or suspense, whatever it may be. It's great.
Hmm.
Corey, sound.
sorry. the sound, I got to tell you, the two things that really stand out to me. One, like Justin said, the sound of the blasters. When they kick those on and you hear them whir up, and when Peter Venkman even says, turn me on, you know, like to get that little thing going. He makes a comment somewhere and says, switch it on or turn it on or something. And they, as they boot up, I just love it. It's going back for those of us that watched the original and when they first fire the proton pack and it has that, it just has a unique sound. It's similar to a lightsaber.
Yep.
It's lightsaber makes its own sound. The Ghostbuster proton packs make their own sound, and they're just.
You reminded me of a thermal detonator from Star Wars. You know that like high pitched whirring almost.
Well, I guess you could say that. In my head, they're very distinct, but. Those right there just caught me from the beginning. Just made me look and say, because I think it showed that this movie's going on nostalgia. This is going to go on references. This is going to go on cameos. This is going to be something that ties directly back to the original. And I don't think the reboot Ghostbusters did that. I think they made it too separate. And it was. It's its own standalone invention. And then the other part was the music, Craig. I never pay attention to music. I always forget to. And I kind of miss most of the music except the old trills that you hear of that piano and the Ghostbuster theme is very apparent in here. And I got to tell you, you listen to those music and those songs, because then I went back and I started playing them on my phone afterwards, like, you know, the old Ghostbuster soundtrack. Stuff doesn't sound the same as it did back then. It's so good and so incredible that what music people made for the original Ghostbuster movie. I mean, it is an epic movie and it is an epic soundtrack. This is kind of like that first, okay, I got a great movie and a great soundtrack all in one. I don't think you got that with every movie out of the 80s. I definitely don't think you get that with all movies now. But that Ghostbuster soundtrack was one I remember as a kid. I had a tape of the Ghostbuster soundtrack and I would have that thing in my tape deck in my car and it was just going on repeat over and over, just playing and then cycle back over to side two, side B, and then go back to side A. I mean, it was just because it was such a good soundtrack from top to bottom.
Yeah, and I think that's a good pull, Corey, because it's 1984, the original one. You're getting right into John Hughes making films. Back to the Future drops the year after this, and that's when you're really starting to hit. Yeah, soundtracks with movies are huge. Purple Rain, I mean, all these things. But prior to that, yeah, that's not, you know, the integration of pop music and movies is not really a thing. But yeah, for me well, too, well, just...
I think, would you think that there's MTV mixed in there?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
This is when, because I remember the Ghostbusters video. Mm-hmm, was Ray Park, but it had cameos of these guys in the video. So they filmed the movie, but they also filmed parts for the video, for his MTV video.
Yeah, Ray Parker Jr., because Ray Park is
Ray Parker Jr. Yeah.
Darth Maul does the music.
Ray Parker.
I think I've said this before on this podcast, but like the 80s, I know this is about the new Ghostbusters and not the 1984 one, but the 80s, just the best movies were made in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like that was
that's the why peak. They keep trying to remake them. Yeah.
That was the peak movie.
And I do love that none of the kids knew about the Ghostbusters. Like they played that angle so well. Like, you guys know who the Ghostbusters were? The what? Like, just, it was a great setup to say, here we are 40 years later. Guess what? Nobody knows.
Yeah. Well, I'll just segue into that. Just that I love how they used YouTube clips for that to bring put actual footage from Ghostbusters 84 in. It was kind of a cool little thing. I also had the original commercial that way, which ends up being a plot point. You know, that's how Phoebe gets the phone number to call Ray. But yeah, the special effects, the sound effects being the same, just absolutely got me immediately. Like, yes, that is what a proton pack sounds like. That is what the PKE meter in the ghost trap. That's what that sounds like. Hearing the Ghostbusters theme, which, I mean, that's the thing a lot of people don't remember, that the Ghostbusters theme is not the Ray Parker Jr. song. That's something else. Like, the Ghostbusters have a theme song also, an instrumental theme, a piano theme that Elmer Bernstein wrote. And you hear that at the beginning as Egon is racing home. You hear it in a kind of a slow, melancholy way when Phoebe is opening up the little, like, the puzzle in the floor to pull out the ghost trap. But the one thing that we didn't quite mention yet that I want to mention here is that you also have that creepy bendy music played by it's called an owned Martineau. It's a French instrument, and it's the same lady. It's Cynthia Miller, who did it for the 84 film, also did it for this. So you get that also, which, like, it's absolutely manipulating our emotions. Like, hey, remember this? Remember how you felt when you saw this movie? Yeah, we're doing that again. But just so well done. So I love how they're incorporating the original themes, the leitmotifs. And then, Justin, you mentioned, you know, using the diegetic music. Like, there's, like, in that diner, you hear the Shirelles, you know, it's like, it puts you in, like, absolutely in Americana, like Midwest, kind of almost feels like it's in the 50s, even though it's 21st century. So I just love that they did that as opposed to, you know, to separate it from the Manhattan aspect of the original films.
The movie so well, and not just with the music, but cinematography, you know, all of it. It did a really good job of, even though it's set in present day, still feeling like it was a 1980s Amblin movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah. And I don't know how they pulled both of those off simultaneously, but they did, and it was great.
Yeah.
You definitely feel like you're still in the same universe. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a timeless aspect to it because of that. Like, there's, you know, kids just aren't sitting around on their phones or, I mean, podcast is like the most 21st century thing that's mentioned, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Podcast. Let's go ahead and talk about performances. Like, I mean, obviously we've been singing McKenna Grace's praises because she's fantastic and everything she's in. She's great in this, and she's the star of this movie in a lot of ways. She's the emotional heart of this movie.
In watching trailers, I don't think I got that out of the trailers. Like, I think anyone would assume that it was Paul Rudd's movie.
Right.
And he is very much secondary character.
And I love Paul Rudd as a secondary character. I think that plays to his strengths too. I think
he's great in small doses. But
I like him. I mean, I like him in lead roles too. But I think when you get to see him kind of restrained like that, it's pretty great. So let's talk about dialogue. Throw out a line or two, Justin, then Corey, then I'll go.
I thought it was interesting. Okay, so when Janine, is it Janine? Is that her name? The secretary from
Melnitz?
Yeah. Yep. that line where she shows, I thought it was interesting she showed up for such a short cameo. I thought she was going to be in it more.
Yeah.
She says, your father wasn't much of a homemaker. He could barely keep the power on, which is funny because that's what killed him. His trap didn't work because the power didn't work.
Dang.
Is that funny though? I don't know.
It's ironic.
And then all of Phoebe's like little dad jokes, I just thought were fantastic. Like they weren't supposed to be funny, but they were so funny. Like the line where she's talking with Gruberson, and I have it written down here, but I've tried triangulating and I can't figure out where they're coming from. And Phoebe says, did you use three phones? Gruberson, yeah, I know how many sides are on a triangle. Phoebe says, I know. I just thought you were being obtuse. Like that's just so.
And she has the cutest wink after that too. Yeah. She winks at him because he's like, "Was that a joke?" Sarcasm. It was just great.
I'm doing three this time because this is a podcast, so I have to mention podcast. But where podcast finds out that Ray is his, he's like, "You're my subscriber." Like
my one
subscriber.
Same dude. Fill it.
Yeah. Thank you, single subscriber, for listening to our podcast. Yes.
All of you subscribers, you're due to our hearts. Seriously. Corey, you got a line or two that you like?
I do. I'm going to tell you this. I'm gonna go with one here, Craig, first to start. Okay. And because you know why? This, I thought, was the perfect way to make a reference back to the original and stayed the character. This is the part where Peter Venkman is Peter Venkman in this movie, right? You bring him back 40 years later. How are you going to do this? And you set him up. When he first makes his appearance and he sees Callie and he says, hi, Peter Venkman from the home office. And you are. And she says, Callie Spangler. And he goes, Spangler? Weird name. Good luck with that. Like, if it's just Peter Venkman's perfect, like, just it's the essence of who he is in this movie, in this arc, in this all the way back to 1984. And it was so perfect. It was delivered perfect. Only Bill Murray can pull off that set and still like to make that. It's a simple line, but it's such a great throwback and it's such in his character to deliver it. And you know, just weird name. Good luck with that. Just kind of letting her know.
Is Venkman Bill Murray? Like, is he just playing Bill Murray? Do you think?
I think he pretty much is. Yeah. And, yeah, shouts to...
Because he's like that in all of his movies. He's got that same
attitude. Yeah, there's a pitch meeting out right now, or recently on the original 1984. He finally did one for that one. They talk about that character and how horrible he is. But how are we going to get someone to like him? It's like, we'll cast Bill Murray.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I did not realize until this most recent rewatch of the 1984 Ghostbusters how terrible of a person he is. Like, he has no likable traits. Why are those people his friends?
And I got to be honest, that could be where... He had a falling out with Harold Ramis. It could be Bill Murray because Bill Murray's had several fallings out. Him and Chevy Chase is kind of a jerk too. Like they don't get along and like they didn't like each other in Caddyshack. And then, I mean, it just kind of shows you that a couple of these guys, there's some egos in check there that.
Yeah. Which is what's so great about getting Murray back for this.
Yeah.
And that he's in the next one and seems to be in a featured role. So.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say, most of what I liked is really, it's Gruberson, it's Paul Rudd's thing. And I'm going to pull out one where it's right before they open the trap. And Phoebe says, are you sure this is safe? And he says, history is safe. Geometry, that's safe. Science is all particle accelerators and hydrogen bombs. Science is giving yourself the plague and gambling on the cure. Science is reckless. She says, science is reckless. And this is the part I wanted. Totally. It's punk rock. It's a safety pin through the nipple of academia. That absolutely is the spirit of Ghostbusters right there.
As a history teacher, I was a little offended by that part. But then I remembered Indiana Jones exists. That's Tell true. Him history's safe.
Justin, do you have another line that you want to share?
real quick. Hey, Corey, why isn't there like a cool movie about, you know, like a cool math teacher?
There are no cool math teachers.
Ah, jeez, Corey, come on.
I don't teach math anymore. I'm science. This is my movie right here. Science. Paranormal.
Darn it. I didn't know that. Anyway, sorry, what was your question, Greg?
Yeah, do you have another line of dialogue you want to share, or did you already?
I gave three. What more do you want from me, man?
You're good. Corey, do you got another one?
I got one.
Go for it.
Yeah, I love, because here I am, right, with the throwbacks, right? I mean, there's a lot of great dialogues and stuff with other parts, but I love the throwback parts. And I love the part where Venkman yells out and calls her Flat Top again, right, from 1984, Gozer. And she says, "Are you a god?"
Yes.
And this time, Ray, because last time Ray said no, and then she electrocuted him. And they were all like, "Okay, come on, Ray." And Ray, yes. And it's just hilarious because then Winston says, "Yeah, we're all gods." And then Peter Venkman goes, "Yeah, I mean, we're all pretty dang special down here. On a personal note, I thought we busted you up for good. I mean, it wasn't working for me. My friends didn't think so. And I know yours didn't." So it's just, it was a great scene. Comes right back, gives us that old, like, okay, we're going to do it right this time. We're going to answer that question and before we set this up and start attacking. So
yeah,
I thought that was a great throwback.
Yeah, right up to the edge of fan service, but not quite for me. I think they handled that well. That was I was going like to be though, my last
I
one.
Mean,
so
Gozer, maybe just Gozer asks that every single time she meets, they meet someone.
Sure, I'm sure it does.
So I don't feel like it was unnecessary.
No, I think it was pitch perfect. I'm going to use, that was going to be my last one, but I'll use another Gruberson one. The first time he and Callie meet, and she says, and this is for, as a teacher, you got to love this. She says, "Can you imagine who they got teaching summer school?" And he says, "I can. I teach here." She's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." It's like, "No, it's okay. It's, look, most of the kids that go here, they're not very bright." And he points at a kid. He's, "I can kind of do whatever I want." She's like, "Score." He's like, "Right? Dream job." She's just like rips him, and then he's just like oblivious. Just he's playing through it. He's good.
And then what movies confidence. Does he show? He plays Cujo and Chucky. Which what school in America are we going to be able to show those movies?
It's summer school.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, we talked about body language. I love. Was it Corey? You pulled out, or who pulled out the wink? Phoebe's wink when she's
her little wink is cute. Yeah.
And she's, I thought you were being obtuse. That's why she calls it out. That's why I wink. I also really liked when Trevor's cold and he gets the sweatshirt from Lucky and she's like, "Yeah, it belongs to my boyfriend." And he just shrugs it off immediately. That was pretty great.
Yeah.
And then I'm just going to say one more and let you guys jump in. Paul Rudd just walking through Walmart, just like he's just feeling so good, just loose and casual, all practically dancing through Walmart as he's going to pick up his ice cream. And it's so funny.
Oh,
you know what? Since we're on that scene, I forgot to mention this. It's not in my notes, but the amount of product placement in this movie was outrageous. It took me out of it. So much.
That didn't bug me.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
There's a lot of product placement in the first one, too,
though. Well, I think there's product placement. I think there's Easter eggs left and right in this movie.
Crunch Bar.
Yeah. Huh?
Crunch Bar.
Oh my gosh! Everything and the Twinkie in the glove box of Ecto-1. Anybody catch that? It's still good. You could eat that 40 years later. I mean, it's filled with so many like little cues and little hidden gaffes that you just kind of look at and go, "Oh my gosh, that's from the old one. That's from the old one." It just catches you. I think it just makes that feeling and that memory come right back.
I'm gonna go one more like earnest and sincere one, because this movie balances that so well. Like, it's just goofy and funny, but it's also just like pulls on the heartstrings. When Callie hugs her dad at the end, oh my gosh. And he never says anything. Egon, Ghost Egon never says anything, but he doesn't need to.
I like that he didn't say anything. I feel like if they made him zany or weird or kooky or, you know, said something, I don't know what the word is. Disrespectful, maybe. I mean, the guy died. Like, I feel like you gotta play him respectfully.
Yeah. And here's one I had. Just the fact that they pull out the classic suits that the kids are wearing, and they don't quite fit because the kids aren't quite ready yet. That's why I read that. Anything else for performance before we talk about setting and design?
No.
Yeah, so filmed in and around Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I mentioned that earlier. I really like the immediately that there's callbacks to the first one when you see the Shandor mining sign. And like, hey, that's the guy from The Thing. Remember that name from Ghostbusters 84? And all of the rusty signs with the Revelation 6:12 all over it. Like, if you'd seen the first movie anytime recently, it's like, I know that. I recognize that.
So I think now's a good time for my question. Does this movie stand? Is it a standalone? Does it work by itself?
Yes. I'm 100% going to say yes.
Like, if you've never seen the original, you think it's still
Jude watched it and thought it was fantastic. He liked it.
And hadn't seen the originals?
He's never seen the original. And after this, I told him, I got to sit down. I realized, I'm like, man, I've got to sit down and make you watch these shows with me.
This movie is more family friendly than the original two films. Those are not, the 80s is a thing where like we watched and listened and heard a lot of things we shouldn't have that would not be acceptable now. Whereas this movie is, this is totally a movie with, like, not just because the kids are protagonists, but this is a family friendly movie in a lot of ways, much more so.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
You're stealing away from my final summary wrap.
No, please. I love that you did that.
Because I think that this movie is a family gear. Here, let me scroll down here to where I put that. Cause I thought I said it well. This one, because it's so nostalgic, right? And it has so many references and cameos and stuff. This movie is a generational saga. Like, this is meant to kind of make a family story that you can watch with a younger generation and an older generation and tie them two together. The older generation's getting all the callbacks and the nostalgia. Younger generation's getting a little bit of the reference of the older generation, but then seeing a new story develop and take place, right? And a new generation with the young Phoebe girl versus, you know, I mean, just continuing on a sequel. I mean, this is great. It's family. It's friendly. It's clean. It's great. A great set.
Some other things before we move down to characters, and thanks for bringing that up. That I like a lot of just Easter egg stuff, like the fact that the underground temple is essentially exactly the same as you see on top of the building in the first movie. But little things like the symmetrical book stacking in Egon's house, because no human being would stack books like this. But just like the Philadelphia mass turbulence of 1947.
Yeah.
Yeah, props. I mean, we mentioned them multiple times already, but just that the props feel like they're pulled right out of the 1984 film, Proton Packs the Ghost Trap. Ecto-1 seeing that back. But now we have a remote control trap, which I think was a cool addition to that. And same thing with like the the gunner chair that pops out. That's pretty great.
The gunner chair I did because I think it was, dang it, I forgot I was going to check that out. I was going to look up, I think it was in the cartoon.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I think it was a kind of a throwback to the cartoon adventures.
When did these cartoons come out? Oh. I do not remember these.
86, maybe?
87? Oh, okay.
The real Ghostbusters, because there was another show called Ghostbusters, which was not based on the film, because the title, there's rights things with that.
Because I used to watch that cartoon growing up as a kid.
Me too, loved
all
it.
All the time. And I used to draw the guys and stuff like in class when I was bored. Now I'm bored, I'm teaching it, but no, yeah, it's like, oh man, I remember just drawing these little guys catching ghosts and I thought the gunner chair was from there. I'm not finding anything, but
I wouldn't be surprised if it's in some other media, a video game or a comic or a cartoon. Either way.
Yeah.
Anything else setting and design we want to talk about before we transition? We've talked about lots of the stuff in other facets. Tobin's spirit guide makes another appearance, which is nice. I like just seeing the podcast gear. Again, as a podcaster, seeing a kid named himself Podcast who has a podcast and podcast gear, it's got to warm your heart.
A little bit.
Characters that we have. Have we talked about anybody? We did not.
I'm gonna say it again, and maybe somebody prove me wrong here, but I really feel like with the exception of like Paul Rudd and McKenna Grace, like everyone else was just unnecessary. Like, they didn't have much of a role. Like, you had the brother Trevor by Finn Wolfhard, like, and then Lucky, the girlfriend, and Podcast. Like, he was there for comic relief. But there was just a lot of, like, why is this character here? We don't need them. Make them do something.
Well, did you watch the original, Justin? Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I watched it.
Because Paul Rudd was Rick Moranis, and the girl, the mom, was Sigourney Weaver. Sigourney Weaver? She became the...
Yeah.
And so it was kind of... I thought it kind of fit.
I'm talking about like Trevor and Lucky specifically, though. Like those two, they had nothing going on for.
You need four Ghostbusters, though.
Yeah.
So they're kind of
flesh them out a little bit more.
That's a fair complaint. Maybe we'll see more of that in the next one. Although it's going to be a crowded cast, so.
I mean, especially Lucky. Like the love interest in there. Like, mm-hmm. did we just need to have a love interest and someone's got to love someone? Like,
she didn't have a lot to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean her main contribution is that fact that her dad's the sheriff, so she can get them out and get Ecto-1 back out, right?
Yeah.
Her access to the sheriff station. And that's fair. Yeah, she's pretty one note.
I was also kind of sad that we only got the one little tiny cameo in the mid credit scene with Sigourney Weaver, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Well,
that was a great pull. Callback though.
It was hilarious.
Electric shocks. And this movie has a post-credit scene. Did you guys stay till the end?
I did.
Wait, what? No, I didn't. No.
Yeah, there is a callback. First off, there's a deleted scene or an extra scene. Yeah, I guess a deleted scene from Ghostbusters 84.
It's the coin, right?
With the coin, and then that is used as a editing bridge to present day where Melnitz takes it to Winston. And that sets up the next movie where he's going to
reopen. Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah.
I have to watch that now.
It's at the very, very end. So, listeners, if you have not watched it all the way to the end, there's some stuff at the end there. Let's see. Yeah. A couple things that I thought were kind of cool. So, obviously, Harold Ramis is not in the film. They CGI'd his face over there. But you also have Bob Gunton is the body double for that, and then you also have Ivan Reitman, the original director, who does a little bit of stand-in for that as well. So it's like three people that made it. J.K. Simmons plays Ivo Shandor. Deep cut for this. This kind of bummed me out because one of the potential castings for Gozer was at one point I was either offered to or they were talking about having Pee Wee Herman play him. And the reason was no. Listen, because and then that Gozer would be a manifestation of Ivo Shandor. He would actually take on the form of Ivo Shandor. Therefore, Pee Wee Herman would have been Paul Reubens would have been Ivo Shandor. So Paul Reubens had not died at this point. So I was like, Ivo Shandor. That would be Paul Reubens, and that would have been kind of a in continuity wrapping that back up together. They didn't go that way. It went J.K. Simmons, which is fine. But I was like, oh, and it wasn't. But that's fine.
It was Olivia Wilde, wasn't it?
Yeah. Little bit part for her. For Gozer this time. Okay. Hero's Journey. We're down to Hero's Journey, Corey.
Well, okay. I don't know. I don't know where you go with the Hero's Journey thing. Depends on which hero of the movie you're looking at. Are you looking at the original Ghostbusters? Or are you looking at the new generation? I feel like there's kind of a continuation of the old heroes becoming the new mentors or the coming at the end to help inspire and take on and lead up the next ones. But I do feel like in a real world, nobody's going to let a bunch of teenagers shoot a million electron volts out of stuff, you know, as a, oh, hey, it's your business now. So I don't know. We'll see how that goes for the next one.
Yeah. Not every story is going to hit that plot point. But I just like to address whether or not it does every time we go through. Yeah. I basically said the same thing in my notes. It's more of a passing of the torch story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you also do have some elements of the monomyth, like we have the outside help where, you know, that looks like they're going to be able to be the four young kids are going to, and, you know, the two new adults will be the ones that can take out Gozer. But then you have to have the originals come back, including Egon. So you do have that little button there. Justin, do you have any thoughts on that, or did we hit it?
No, sorry, I was processing what you're saying. No, I would. I'd agree with that.
We've talked about world building a lot, I guess, with this too. I think that. See, and I'm interested now. It's, you know, Corey, that you've put out there that this does basically work on its own, because I said that really it relies on a lot of the world building of the original film, but yeah. Then it also builds on it because you get like a whole lot more about Evo Shandor. You get a little bit more of his backstory. They talk about the mines or where they got the selenium, which is what they used in the building in Manhattan. So I liked all of that background stuff. And then there, you know, the 84 incident was just one of many. Like they showed that, I should have mentioned this in set decoration. There was like that listing of numbers. I like that too. Like there's an in-universe reason why this is happening now.
Yes.
And it happened in 84 and it happened at these other disturbances. And
there's a payoff.
Yeah. So I liked that.
Well, and the part that here's why this movie could be a standalone. They call back to the old story just enough and make it to the young generation. Don't you guys know who the Ghostbusters were? No, we don't know. And so then don't you ever have watched YouTube? So then they go on YouTube and they find some clips and they got the old original commercials and they got a couple clips of stuff. And so you kind of look and you go, okay, I see just enough that these guys who come in at the end of the movie are legends from something similar to this. I don't have to know the whole story. I could literally just watch this movie and go, oh, these guys. It's kind of like, you know, you just hear these guys were great and you never actually had seen them play, but there's an aura of them as they come in and you're like, oh, their reputation has been built and established through the YouTube videos and everything we got going on. So I feel like I like that part. I feel like that's why it could be a standalone movie separate from the other two.
Okay. Am I wrong? No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
looks like we might have lost Justin. So we'll just wrap up with some final thoughts. Corey, why don't you keep going with the, if you have any other final thoughts?
I tell you, you look at this Ghostbusters and you got to call back to 2016 Ghostbusters with Melissa McCarthy and that was a great cast. That casting was perfect. That I really like that movie. I think the end got a bit off the rails for me. Not all of the ending, but the whole the ghost and the battle stuff got a little too far. I thought it was a little too much, right? And so when I look at that, I think the reboot definitely tried to hammer home the comedy of the original franchise, right? Because when you look back in the 80s, there was a lot of comedy. It was a horror comedy kind of thing. And they had very distinct characters, right? A lot of humor, a lot of irony. I just think they overshot that ending too much and they went too far. And that's why that movie got a 62% on Rotten Tomatoes. But then you look at this Ghostbuster Afterlife and it just absolutely goes on nostalgia. It's a family film, captures exactly what you want with the original in a great way. I think this film is a generational saga, kind of continuing of the story. Could be its own standalone, but it also is a generational saga to bring in the younger and the older viewer alike. And but still brings in some great comedy and laugh and kind of calls back to that generation time. And so I absolutely loved it. I think it's a fantastic movie. I can't wait to watch the new one. I'm going to go see it in the theaters because then there's something about being in the theaters and being so focused and immersed in the world because you can't have your phone out. Can't distract you. When I'm at home, I have my phone out. Dogs walk in, the cat needs fed. Something, right? Something always gets you. And so I'd say my final thought would be for something like this, if it's a movie you're like, well, I kind of think it might be good. Go watch it in the theater because you'll give it your full attention. And it's definitely worth it. There's a place for the theater still.
Yeah, I'm absolutely excited to see this in the theater. I'm going to take the kids. So I think they really liked the last one. It absolutely, I think this movie is a really just a fun legacy sequel that, unintended, captures the spirit of the original film. I will also say that the Harold Ramis CGI is some of the best that I have ever seen.
Yes.
It is like, I don't want to put something down, so I'm just going to just say it's great. And absolutely, in a very emotional moment, it absolutely nails it. And I think if it had been done halfway, the moment would not have worked as well as it does. That's just such a great, perfect moment. And, you know, then it says the two words for Harold as it pans. Just, it's so good. Just, yeah, I can see your face, Corey.
Just it made emotional. Me cry. Like, just, yeah. I'm serious.
It's because you're not you dead inside, Corey.
I'm not dead inside. And because here's why. If you were one of those original guys, those cast members, and I got to believe that they do this, you would have a still shot somewhere in your room to remember. You know, like you'd have this, like, you know, office. They would have to have like a framed photo of them firing their guns, you know, the proton packs from the 84 movie. Like, oh my gosh, look at this time in my life. Here's all four of, like, that same angle, same camera. And yep. Then you think, you go and make this movie 40 years later and Harold's gone. I got to feel like that's a perfect photo right there. Like, when I saw that photo, I thought, oh my gosh, if I was those three guys, I'd have snapshot that. I'd have made a photographer take that, frame it for me, and put it right next to another shot, because it's like, he really is gone, but he's still there. Like, it's a beautiful moment. And if you can't see it, you're heartless inside.
Absolutely. So on that note, we just want to say thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to connect with us, you can find us on X and Facebook. Email us at readingbetweenreels@gmail.com. Or use the SpeakPipe app on our website. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast catcher. One last thing, our next episode will be a review of Mission Impossible with David Jesse from the Tatooine Sons podcast. Send us an email or voicemail about your favorite moments from Mission Impossible. We'll share it on the next episode.